I'm in Boulder, Colorado, University of Colorado. It's March 4th, 2008, and I'm talking to Dr. Sharon Colling, who's a professor in environmental studies. Thanks
yes.
for talking to me.
Yes, sure.
Can you tell me a little bit about your latest research?
Sure. So let me just, my name is pronounced Collins. Don't worry about it. Yeah. I probably mispronounced your first name. It's Andrea?
Yeah.
I always get Andrea and Andrea. I can never keep those straight. So, okay, Andrea.
I can't move my mouth properly today.
That's okay. I'm right there with you. So I study basically conservation and restoration of rare species, and I'm interested in how human activities affect the loss and fragmentation of habitat and how species cope with those changes. So as we alter the landscape by building cities and towns and agricultural fields and cutting down forests, how does that change the landscape available for different species that live there, plants and animals primarily, that I'm studying? So I've been doing that for almost 20 years now. That's been the focus of my research. And I've studied all sorts of species, primarily in grasslands, both in California and in Colorado. And one of the specific projects that I've been working on most recently is trying to understand how this altered landscape affects disease spread and transmission. And so I've been studying plague in prairie dogs here in Colorado, as well as other grasslands in neighboring states, and trying to understand how the transformation of the Front Range in particular through urbanization has affected prairie dogs directly, and also the interaction of prairie dogs with this pathogen. And it's the same bacterial pathogen that affected people in the Middle Ages.
Wow.
Plague. Yersinia pestis is the name of the bacterium, and it was introduced to North America from Asia probably around 1900.
Hmm.
There was actually a huge outbreak in San Francisco right around 1902, 1904, where they quarantined part of the city because people were affected. So it was introduced to North America probably from rats that were on ships that came into the ports of Los Angeles and San Francisco. And it has spread eastward across the United States to about the middle of the country. And people don't really understand why it sort of stopped there. Mm-hmm. But it moved from the rats, the pest species, into wild species. And so now it's in a lot of different wild species of rodents and carnivores, primarily mammal species. Anyway, I guess there is a relevant piece of that with climate, in that one of our efforts in that study was to understand both basically, why do these outbreaks of plague occur when they do and where they do?
Right.
Because prairie dogs are particularly susceptible. So when this pathogen enters a prairie dog colony, most of the prairie dogs die, if not all of them.
Mm.
And they're so visible because they're active during the day and they're colonial. So you can walk or drive or ride your bicycle by a colony and you see them out there, you know, doing their thing.
Yeah.
When they aren't there, it's very obvious.
Hmm.
So we know when a prairie dog colony dies out because they're all gone.
So how do you actually physically do this kind of research? What is the process?
Well, the past few years we had large teams of field assistants, and we would go out into these study sites around Boulder and set two kinds of traps. Basically, one is an aluminum box that you use for very small mice and voles and those sorts of things. And the other trap is slightly bigger, and that's for prairie dogs. And so you basically set these traps, you bait them, and the animal comes into the trap. You go the next morning, you get the animal out of the trap, and then we put them under anesthesia with a field setup that we've devised. And we collect all the fleas off of the animal because the fleas are the vectors for the pathogen. And we collect a blood sample from the animal, and that's screened up at the Centers for Disease Control. And then we take standard measurements, weight, length, that sort of thing. And then the animal wakes up and we let him go.
Mm.
So we've done that with literally thousands of small mammals and prairie dogs over the last 4 years. And so
it
that's
gives you a picture of what's happening over the...
Right. I mean, the the reason we were trapping the small animals is because it's thought that they are the ones who actually carry the disease to the prairie dogs. There's sort of several ideas about how plague spreads from one colony to another. And some people thought, well, it must be the prairie dogs. You know, they move from one colony to another. Somebody's sick, and they move to another colony. That's not a very likely explanation, because prairie dogs typically only move between colonies once in their life.
Right.
And that's when they're about a year old, and they're basically leaving home. And it's usually just the males. So they disperse to a new colony so that they avoid inbreeding.
Right.
Not only does that not is that not likely because plague tends it's not a likely explanation because plague tends to show up later in the year, like usually July, August, September, which is past that dispersal phase. The other reason why it seems unlikely is that it would have to be a sick prairie dog that would leave,
right?
An infected prairie dog. And this disease acts so fast with them. Basically, they're dead within a week. I mean, they get sick and they die really fast. So then people said, well, it must be the other small mammals that are out there in the habitat. They're carrying fleas. They could be infected. Maybe they just don't, they aren't so susceptible.
Yeah.
So that's why we did all that other trapping. And basically, now it's looking like that's not a very likely explanation either.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so we still don't really know how it gets there to begin with. Some people have suggested maybe it's harbored in the soil, that it can stick around in the soil and that and the activity of things like nematodes, which you learned about in Antarctica, that they may actually have them in their in the biofilm on their external surface. They may actually carry these bacteria. They may be, there may be environmental triggers that cause the bacteria to become active. I mean, it's that's something that we were hoping to study with a small seed grant, and we didn't get funded, so we haven't explored that. But
so
anyway.
how do you then take that and relate that to urbanization and how urbanization is affected?
So we have these colonies that are situated in very different settings. So some are just right next to housing developments and office parks, and others are still within Boulder County, but they're, you know, basically surrounded by grassland. We're working on the land managed by the city and county open space departments, and so they have a variety of, I mean, they have thousands of acres of grasslands, and so they have a variety of settings in which these prairie dog colonies occur. So then we can say, okay, you know, here are these colonies, they have these characteristics, and they have been exposed to plague in the past, you know, few years, or they are experiencing a plague outbreak right now. Is there something about the surrounding landscape that can help us understand that? And what we found when we did that analysis was that it was kind of unexpected that colonies that were near roads, streams, and reservoirs tended to not get exposed to plague, and colonies that weren't in those situations did. So urbanization wasn't really part of that, except in the in this road effect. So we started thinking, well, what do those all have in common? I mean, what would why would those affect the occurrence of plague? And our hypothesis, again, we don't know if this is true, but that if plague moves as the result of movement of some animal, then maybe those things serve as barriers to movement of an animal that's moving the pathogen around. It might also be that, you know, near a reservoir, for example, that the microclimate is slightly different. It's maybe a little more humid, or but we haven't been able to really detect that and support that.
So when you get this data from your field work, how does it then get analyzed? Is that just kind of are there computer models that are used, or is it the data tables are just kind of looked at and interpreted?
We use statistical models, basically multiple regression, that sort of thing, to try and come up with the factors that best explain the outcome, when and the outcome in this case is either, you know, the occurrence of plague or the number of fleas on an animal, or, you know, those are some of the responses that we're looking at. The abundance of certain species of animals, or what factors explain those responses, those outcomes.
And when you're putting together these statistical models, how Well, in some of the, I've talked to some climate scientists about models.
Uh-huh.
One great quote that I had was that a model is like a cartoon,
uh-huh.
and that it's really a really kind of simplified sketch of what's
mm-hmm.
going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, with these kinds of models of more biological systems, which I haven't spoken to anyone about, so I'm really interested,
mm-hmm.
Is it the same kind of, because it seems like there are so many variables in, you know, what's happening in a
mm-hmm.
biological system. How do you decide what to keep and what to exclude, or do you, I mean, how do these
right.
models?
They're slightly different
mm-hmm.
types of models, because
okay.
you're probably mostly talking about simulation models where
yes.
you try to basically imitate
mm-hmm.
some phenomenon and so that you can understand it. If you can accurately imitate it, then you must have all the right parts in there.
Yeah.
And these statistical models are more just trying to explain all the variability in the outcome that we see. So
okay.
some colonies have a lot of mice, some don't have very many. Is there some factor that we can isolate that explains that? And through the use of statistics, basically you can see if the variation in that outcome kind of is reflected by variation in some other factor like rainfall or the amount of roads surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
But you never can explain all the variability, right? So there's always some scatter around that linear relationship that you're looking for. There's always they don't fit, you know, you can't ever predict
mm-hmm.
it perfectly. And so there's always some variation that's left unexplained. And then you either say, well, that's okay, I explained it well enough, or you go out and you try to collect more information to be able to predict the response even better. So
mm-hmm.
what is it that we can't explain? What is it about that colony? Maybe it's because it's really big, or I don't know, you know, something like that.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, very much.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about things that, you know, this problem of variability and this problem of prediction related to climate
mm-hmm.
and public understanding and sort of trust of science.
Right.
And that there's a lot mm-hmm. of mistrust about, or a lot of controversy about climate change science and the public understanding. Has that been something that you found in terms of the biological stuff? Like,
yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
For
it comes
example.
Up with endangered species stuff
oh,
a lot.
Yeah.
Like, well, how many wolves are there? Or how many owls are there?
Right.
And I give this analogy to my students here because it's appropriate for students in college. I say, well, what if somebody came up and asked you, how tall is a college student? You would say, well, you know, about, you know, 5'8", but some are 5'2", and some are 6'4". And they say, well, wait a minute, no. How tall is a college student? You know, as if they're all the same. And so
right.
that's an analogy. I mean, you can't say, you know, how big is an owl, or how many owls are there? I mean, those sorts of questions always have this uncertainty, this variability.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the question about how many are there is a slightly different question. That's a slightly different problem. It's not that there's variability in the, well, you know probably what I'm trying to say. It's not that, you
yeah.
know, it's not a,
are they
completely analogous.
Are they, yeah.
Right, but it's just that because you can't see them all, you know, and you can't always find them all,
mm-hmm.
then there's uncertainty in that estimate. But, you know, with plague, it's been interesting. People want to know, well, is plague going to happen this year? You know,
right.
and so we've tried to understand the climate factors that are
mm-hmm.
that are responsible for, that correlate, I should say. I mean, we don't know if it's cause and effect, but are there certain climatic
right.
variables that correlate? And that's what I was starting to get to, and then I got carried away on something else. But
uh-huh.
So here in Boulder, March tends to be a really wet month,
mm-hmm.
and we tend to get a lot of snow in March, and people have sort of anecdotally observed that when we get a really heavy snowfall in March, we tend to get more plague. And so some people have actually constructed these statistical models for
mm-hmm.
the Four Corners area and have shown that human plague cases, and actually hantavirus cases as well, track well with climate.
And so there are human plague places that are happening.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Somebody just died a couple months ago.
Really?
Down in Bandelier. This wildlife biologist skinned a mountain lion that had died. And he got exposed and he died.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, if you know you have it, you can be treated because it's, you can use antibiotics because it's bacterial. Mm. But anyway, so we try to do the same kind of thing with climate factors and plague here in Boulder. Well, as you've probably learned from being here already, the climate is really variable.
Yes. Yeah.
And actually from year to year, it varies a ton. And so we didn't find any kind of match with the number of plague cases in prairie dogs and the climate for Boulder. Now, we did up for a study site in Montana that's been studied for the last 20 years. And it was similar to what was shown down in the Four Corners, which is basically that you get heavy rainfall, you get a heavy rainfall in a particular year, the following year you get more plague cases. So if it rains or snows a lot in March, then basically the hypothesis is that sort of feeds the plants. The plants become more lush, they reproduce more, that builds up the mouse populations, and so by the following year you've got a lot of mice, a lot of disease, a lot of plague. So it's this 1 year lag. It's not March this year and plague in August.
Right.
But that's kind of what people thought was happening, and that doesn't seem to fit any of the analyses that have been done. But the idea then is if we play around with climate a little bit, maybe that will cause more disease, because there is this connection between climate and plague, at least.
And how would you prove something like that? Would that be a more of a prediction model than would be?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there, I actually have a postdoc who worked with me, who's from Sweden, and he's back in Sweden now. He worked carefully with the Montana and the Colorado. Actually, he didn't work with the Colorado data because we didn't get this effect. He worked carefully with the Montana data, and one thing he'd like to do is to take it further and simulate some climate change scenarios, basically, that the climate change scientists have come up with and ask, well, if we change the climate in Montana as it's predicted to change, what will that do to the number of plague cases? So it's pretty straightforward use of those climate models.
Well, it seems like the work that you're doing is really, something that is really important for the public to kind of understand. What in your experience has been difficult for you to communicate to the public? Or what is there a disconnect as far as your research and the public being able to understand not just what you're doing, but also like how they might respond to it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, right, let's see.
Because I imagine there's like, ideas about panic. You know, you mentioned about plague, and it's like, wow.
Yeah. I mean, people are definitely fearful of plague. Mm-hmm. Around here, unfortunately, people very closely associate plague with prairie dogs. And they think that prairie dogs are the ones who are causing more plague.
So they want to wipe them out.
Right, so they want to get rid of them. I mean, there's sort of the people who love them and the people who hate them, and not much in between.
And which one are you?
Well, I'm a big fan of all life, so, I like them. And they're really interesting. They're interesting creatures. They communicate, they
make great sounds.
Very interesting behaviors, that has been one issue. I mean, I haven't done a lot of public communication on this issue, but one big issue is it the prairie dogs that are causing me to get plague? Well, actually, no. It's probably the mice, or it's probably some other, the prairie dogs are just kind of like the canary in the coal mine. They're the ones who get sick and die, but they're not spreading it, most likely, just because of this very quick manifestation that they have of the disease. And then the other thing is trying to communicate with the open space managers about, well, how should we manage prairie dogs? Because they overgraze. I mean, people say this all the time. Oh, they just eat the vegetation down to nothing, and we get these weedy, dusty patches, and what should we do? And so trying to think about prairie dogs themselves and kind of how they fit into an urban landscape. I mean, what do you do?
Right.
Because they can't move. And they do tend to overexploit their local patch of ground because they don't have anywhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you get them in a place where there's more continuous habitat, they don't tend to you know, overexploit it so much. But these colonies, like right next to the roadsides that you see along Foothills Parkway, or
right.
you know, those are pretty much scorched earth patches.
Uh-huh.
And there's not enough space for them.
Now I noticed you were doing some stuff about where you were studying species diversity in relationship to these mm-hmm, peridot mm-hmm, colonies. Mm-hmm. What have you been finding there?
So with that, it's if you look just at this at a colony itself, then the diversity of mammals, the number of species of mammals, is actually lower on a prairie dog colony than off a prairie dog colony.
Okay.
And that's sort of counterintuitive, because people have argued, oh, prairie dogs are a keystone species. They're a foundation species, which means they affect the abundance and distribution of lots of other species. So they're good. We should keep them because they're you know,
right.
keeping the ecosystem healthy, essentially. Well, if you just look at a colony, that's not true for small mammals.
Uh-huh.
But then if you expand your scope and you say, well, let's look at places that do have prairie dogs and places that don't have prairie dogs. And then if you look at that spatial scale, there is higher diversity, right? Because you've got lots of small mammals on these grasslands that don't have prairie mm-hmm. dogs, fewer small mammals, but sort of different ones on colonies that do, or places that do have prairie dogs.
Right.
So overall, at a broader scale, the diversity is higher with prairie dogs in the picture. And then if you include things like bald eagles and golden eagles and red-tailed hawks and snakes and, you know,
right.
a host of other predators, species that live in their burrows, then they do enhance the diversity of the grasslands. So that's one reason why people want to conserve them, the people who mm-hmm. do want to conserve them, the people who don't want to get rid of them, is because they enhance the overall diversity of grasslands.
So has your perspective about these species that you study changed over the, you know, you said you've been studying for 20 years or
uh-huh.
so. How has your perception of how these colonies and things work, how has that changed over time for you? Has the science sort of advanced and the models advanced? Or?
Well, if I think more broadly, so the prairie dog study is pretty recent.
Yeah.
If I think more broadly about my field of research, yeah, I mean, I think we've gotten better at figuring out what factors influence species declines and species extinctions.
Mm-hmm.
This notion that disease might play an important role is pretty recent.
Oh, really?
So when I started studying, you know, back in 1990, basically, the big thing was habitat loss is what is driving species extinct, and that's still true. I mean, we know
mm-hmm.
that if you lose habitat, you're going to lose the species. That's just pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, there weren't that many studies showing that disease actually contributed to species declines and extinctions. And now we've got the amphibian declines from the chytrid fungus. Okay, that's and some species have gone extinct as a result of that. You might have heard of the Tasmanian devil facial tumor disease. Have you heard of this?
Not.
This is fascinating. I mean, it's kind of gruesome.
Uh-huh.
But Tasmanian devils are actually quite cute. But they have they've developed this cancer, basically.
Mm.
They get these facial tumors, and it turns out it's contagious. It's a contagious cancer. So they spread it to one another, probably through male aggression, through fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there aren't that many Tasmanian devils, and there's a real possibility that they're going to go extinct due to this disease.
Wow.
So they're trying to do all sorts of things to prevent that, like they're taking a small collection of uninfected individuals and putting them on an island off of Tasmania so that they'll be sort of sequestered.
Wow.
Problem with that is they're predators, right? And these islands have been used as sort of refuges for native birds.
Oh, and so
which
other
are,
species
yeah.
are getting...
So it's a disaster, really. But
yeah.
There's just an article... Where did I see that? There's been a little bit more press about the Tasmanian devil facial tumor disease, FTD. But
mm-hmm.
the really sort of astonishing thing is that it's a cancer that's contagious.
Huh.
So...
Like, makes me think, you know, that what, you know, kind of what happens in the life cycle of these... other species are really similar to, you know, humans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I suppose disease is really the cause of most of our tests as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you asked about what has changed. I think, you know, that area of sort of the relationship between the changes in the landscape and our own health.
Mm-hmm.
Has become much more prominent. So for, you know, for the first 5 or 10 years that I was in this field, it was like, you know, it was mostly focused on, well, we alter the habitat and we cause declines and extinction of other species. And most people, you know, in their daily life don't really worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's an additional sort of bit. Well, if we change the landscape, it may actually increase our susceptibility to disease. By changing the species that are present in these landscapes, and most of the diseases, the infectious diseases that we get are shared with wildlife.
Mm.
You know, if you think about,
right,
lots of, well, AIDS probably came from, you know, monkeys, and you know, all these diseases that we get, hantavirus, you know,
mm-hmm.
malaria, they're all shared. And so how we affect the environment does ultimately affect us. And
so you feel now that there's a more of a sense of urgency to this kind of work.
Yeah, and then you throw the climate change piece in, and many scientists are arguing that climate change has the potential to alter disease risk by, like, for example, you know, increasing the geographic range of mosquitoes that carry malaria. So we'll have more mosquitoes, you know,
mm-hmm.
further north than we did. And
right.
So, you know, combining those two, if we change the landscape and we have climate change, we may, you know, we may be endangering ourselves in ways that we didn't expect. So
you're teaching in this program of environmental studies that is very interdisciplinary. And, you know, yesterday we spoke to Larry McDaniel, who's involved in this initiative at NCAR, who's involved in this initiative to try to bring more social sciences into
mm-hmm.
atmospheric research.
Mm-hmm.
And this program sounds to me like it's really a it's got economics, and it's really an integrated program. Why bring the scientists together with economics and
mm-hmm.
you know, these other kind of social sciences?
Well, you know, we feel that any environmental problem has a social and ethical and cultural context, basically, and that any solution is going to have to combine those approaches, because it's science isn't enough. I mean, in fact, science often is just one little bit of information that goes into a whole bunch of bits of information that go into making a decision. So, I think scientists have been a bit slow to appreciate that. And I guess one thing that we feel really positive about with the environmental studies program is that we feel we're kind of at the forefront of really making that making that really viable. You know, educating people that can really address those issues from an interdisciplinary perspective. So there have been a lot of undergraduate programs in environmental studies, and they're very valuable. And we added this graduate program because we really want to sort of push it even further. So we're educating people that maybe already are in another field. Maybe they're in the business world, or maybe they're a lawyer, maybe they're a journalist, whatever, and they want to come back and get some environmental education. We're also educating PhDs who will go on to do research and teach. So we're really hoping
PhDs
to...
PhDs in environmental studies.
Yeah, yeah. So we have sort of a straight master's program where students do a thesis. We have dual degrees with the law school and the business school, where
mm-hmm.
people can get an MBA and an environmental studies master's at the same time. Just takes a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
And our hope is that, I mean, I guess, is that we will just sort of extend the knowledge well beyond the sciences and into all of these other arenas of society, because we really feel like we definitely need people equipped to think broadly about
mm-hmm.
issues. You know,
why do you think there's so much resistance in the part of the sciences? This is what Larry was kind of talking about too.
I think fear is a big part of it,
mm-hmm.
and just fear and sort of
fear of what?
Fear of not knowing. I mean, being an expert, right?
Oh.
So I mean,
mm-hmm.
we've really been trained as scientists to think only about, you know, this very small thing, and to not extrapolate beyond our, you know, data, and I mean, that's just grilled into your head,
mm-hmm.
and I think many scientists then feel that that they don't want to get into, you know, realms of discussion where they are uncomfortable. I think another thing is that, I know this is true, that a lot of scientists feel that there is, science is pure. I mean, there are the data, and the data are the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that should guide everything, right? Well, we know the truth, so let's just act according to the truth, kind of, you know? We know the climate's changing.
Yep.
What's the problem? Why are we hesitating at all? Well, that's not the only truth. I mean, there are many truths, and some of them have to do with poverty, and some of them have to do with, you know, all sorts of things. And so I think that's been a real resistance, because scientists get frustrated because they say, well, we know the answer. I mean, why do we need to talk about interdisciplinarity? I mean, we know the answer.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, you have to communicate that. You have to
make
it work economically. I mean, make it work in a social justice sort of way. I mean, so
I
many pieces.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's becoming more clear now, just with this, you know, kind of the resistance from governments and corporations to doing anything about climate change. I think it's probably making it more clear to the scientists that, you know, there needs to be a way to bridge that gap somehow.
Yeah, and it's really shocking to most scientists that if you tell them that scientific information isn't enough, because a lot of scientists say, well if we could just figure it out, if we just had got, you know, if we could figure out how many, figure out what to do with these Tasmanian devils, or I don't know, I can't think of a good example. If we could just get the scientific data, then
if we were 100% certain of, you know, anthropogenic warming, then we would convince everyone.
Yeah, but it's, even if we knew everything, it's still, you still have to work within a societal context, and that's one thing that's really hard for scientists to grasp, because it's almost like this fervor, you know. We have the data, we have the answer. It's objective, it's real, it's true. And, I mean, there is something to fall back on with science, of course. The data, you know, are supposed to be objective.
Right.
More objective than someone's opinion about something. Mm-hmm. But, anyway, that's an interesting...
You know, I noticed, just from, like, the readings that you've been sending and what you've been talking about with your research, that, you know, a lot of them talk about, and this just ties into some things that I was talking about with some of the climate scientists, and this idea of geoengineering projects, you know, to address global warming. And I noticed that with some of the articles kind of talk about ways that, I guess you wouldn't call it bioengineering, but ways that things were done to address a certain problem and then caused other problems in terms of... biological systems. What's your take on that kind of a thing? I mean, do you think that there should be kind of as little intervention as possible, or it just depends on the situation? Or
yeah, that's a hard one. You know, because a great example in ecology is biological control, which was its response to all the spraying of chemicals, you know, in the 60s to get rid of insect pests. And so people said, hey, we can just control insect pests with their predators. So let's go back to where they were native, and let's find a predator, and let's introduce that predator, and we'll solve the problem. Well,
it was a disaster.
It was a disaster in most cases. Not all cases, but it has been, you can just read example after example of pretty much cane toads in Australia, you know. I mean, so that was a solution that seemed clean, it seemed...
environmental.
Yeah, environmental. It seemed well thought out, and it has caused a lot of problems. So I guess, I mean, I just, I get really nervous about solutions that seem, you know, like they're just gonna take care of everything, especially when you're dealing with biological systems. There's just so many things we don't understand about interactions among species and relationships with climate, and you know, it's just too complex. And so if you can work with the natural system to achieve some of those solutions, that's why I think in the case of mitigating carbon emissions, for example, I mean, I'm much more sold on the natural options, like let's replant more forests, let's stop burning, you know, let's, now I don't know, and I probably should have from the reading that we're talking about today, you know, can that really solve the problem, or are these technical solutions going to reduce carbon emissions way more, or solve the problem way more than, not reduce emissions, but take care of the excess CO2 way more effectively than the natural solutions
would. Yeah, time is a huge factor.
Right, right.
At the moment.
But I just you know, a little nervous about things like that, because I think we have some pretty good examples of where we've gone wrong with that.
So did you have anything that you wanted to ask or clarification? Or
yeah, actually, something you said when you were talking about Paradox is a keystone species, and the idea of scale, and then you're talking about time span. And I was just wondering how, either how you deal with that in your research, or how your models deal with that kind of variable scale, and have you found like a happy medium where you can look at this particular scale and get a good idea of what you're looking at, or do you need to use different kinds of scales and different kinds of methods?
Yeah, it is a good question. Yes, we have. Incorporated the idea of spatial scale a little bit, and I guess temporal scale too, with the trying to connect climate to the plague occurrence. But one thing we do is, like when I was talking about the surrounding roads, lakes, and streams, right? So if you imagine a prairie dog colony, you can imagine what the landscape looks like right around the colony, and then maybe, you know, half a kilometer away, and then maybe a kilometer away, and at which scale do the prairie dogs kind of feel that, right? Is it just what's right next to them, or do they feel, you know, feel in quotes,